I'm curious about how this is all landing with you, and yeah, okay, great. So some hands going up, etc. Thank you, Shazoe.
I wanted to ask you to go back to something you said about awareness and this different conceptualizing, I use with some hesitation that word, of awareness in the way that you're talking about it from an early Buddhist text and maybe later understandings, and this difference between awareness as a momentary process and awareness is something that we can rest in as a refuge. and I guess I'm really interested in this. Wow, there's kind of a different possibility there. One of the ways that I have, I think, experienced awareness and also kind of explained it in my teaching is as something that's kind of always there that we can access. So there is a sense of some constancy about this knowing, this awareness. And I'm just wondering if what you're indicating is maybe something different.
Well, just to give, perhaps I'll give a personal response.
Please, first,
and then, you know, I think it's just I've found it helpful to come to see that there are different views of mind from within the Buddhist tradition, quite a wide range of different views. I think I really appreciate the perspective offered by someone like Joseph Goldstein, who sees these as different skillful means that can have different, you know, at least some of them can have different value and be very useful in different ways at different times in practice. Certainly the early Buddhist view is this sense of a momentary knowing that comes and goes, that can seem, from this perspective of early Buddhism, can seem continuous, but in fact is happening very fast. And I think that can be very helpful for breaking up some of the reifications, because it's very easy to have a slightly sort of, not quite Ladybird Book of Mindfulness view of it, just since that has come out, but just a slightly naive sense of, well, it's just being, and I'm just going to be here. And, you know, that can be useful, because that can be useful at a stage of practice, because actually if I'm being with it, there's probably less rumination, papancha, selfing, worlding, timing going on. So helpful, but not an ultimate truth. And it's easy for it to get reified as that's all it's about, just be. Not according to the Buddha, you know. And part of what I appreciate about this early Buddhist model is it breaks up the experience. Because I can have a sense of, well, it's just be awareness, you know. And again, that can be so helpful and peaceful, and a lot of selfing and world-creating can quieten with that. And I think it's can be a useful stage in practice. But the Buddha is saying, don't rest there. Don't stop there. There's a deeper freedom that's possible. And that, you know, I find this view is a helpful challenge to that. Because there will be lots of reifying. It's very easy, for instance, when one's doing, say, the not-self practice, where you're practicing saying body is not self, emotional states is not self, thoughts is not self. What tends to happen is the self, the identification, defaults to identification with awareness. So, and some traditions, you know, actually affirm that and say witness consciousness or something like that. So I'm identifying with awareness. Well, the Buddha says, no, that too is not self. You know? And when I start to see awareness as not self and notice that awareness itself is fabricated, is constructed, is a formation in that sense, one gets a sense of the hinterland beyond that view that says just be awareness, you know, and that there's a more radical seeing, releasing, emptying that can take place. So, as I say, I really appreciate this, as rather than trying to work out, you know, well, this one is right and that one is wrong. Personally, I have felt it helpful to see them as skillful means that operate in different ways, constellate experience in different ways. And what I really appreciate about this view, as I say, is I think there's a very radical liberating that it can help enact. John?
May want to say something different.
Only slightly. I'm probably less charitable than Chris on this issue. Just picking up again on something that Chris said within his reply to you there, which I think is this notion of, in some ways, trying to smuggle the notion of self back in somehow into experience. What the Buddha teaches in these early texts is very radical and actually probably much more in line with contemporary cognitive scientific explorations of consciousness, and certainly much more in line with what's been going on in the West since the late 19th century as phenomenological expressions of consciousness, and particularly as it's coming through people like Francisco Varela, Evan Thompson, and people like this who are engaged in consciousness studies. In that, the primary dimension of awareness, or what we're calling consciousness here, actually, is that it's always intentional. Now, that sounds technical. What I mean by that is consciousness is always about or of something. Yeah? There is never, and that gets away from that static notion, which I referred to at the sort of Indian background, of the idea of a static consciousness which is always there, yeah, either within the individual or in the universe, and placing it back into what actually is consciousness, in that it only ever comes with a content. That's the about or the ofness of consciousness. And that is fluctuating, and that's the idea with the momentariness, although it's not mentioned in the very early text. The momentariness comes in because it's changing from object to object. Yeah? As I'm suddenly aware of my thought processes, to my awareness of you, to my awareness of a sound going out here, it's fluctuating at an enormously quick rate. So instead of the idea of the identical same thing, you know, which again is very easy to posit as actually that's the real nature of you, is your awareness or your consciousness, and that's what was going on actually in Indian thought at that time, there's the idea of replacing that sense of identity with continuity. You know? So rather than something identical passing through time, what you've got is moments of consciousness, and you know, when we speak about moments, you can't put a duration on these, it's really an abstract way of speaking, of consciousness acts being preceded by other consciousness acts. And the temporalizing process itself of that actually is our sense of I. But not as a static phenomena, but only as something which is occurring through this process of the movement of consciousness in all of my... I mean, as we sit here, if you just think about it at the moment, the amount of intentional acts of consciousness that is going on in this moment, as you're aware of your seat, as you're aware of the hearing, as you're aware of your visual phenomena, you know, and your thoughts at the same time in trying to understand what's being said. You know, there's a huge amount going on. In terms of experience, sometimes, and you know, when we don't take that step back and start to look at it, it feels like it's the same thing in experience. And so the way often I describe these later attempts in Buddhism to understand the nature of consciousness, or awareness as you're calling it here, is primarily just a report on experience rather than a philosophical or ontological position. It's primarily trying to understand, or just giving a report on how it feels, yeah, rather than it being the same thing. Now, the Buddha was not alone in doing this. I mean, thinkers from the late 18th century all the way through to the contemporary era have started to look at this is the primary dimension of consciousness, but it's always this intentional activity, that there is never consciousness without it being consciousness of something. And that's a momentary act there. So when we start talking about a sort of background awareness, we're getting into forms of thinking that end up being much more like soul, like self, rather than this, well, for his own time, which was an extremely radical position. You know, Hume expresses it quite well at the end of the 18th century. Every time I look inside myself for myself, all I find is bundles of perception. You know? In other words, momentary acts of perception. Very, very similar to what the Buddha is doing. But, and when you get into later thought in the West, people like Husserl, Heidegger, Sartre, now, all of these are really positing this notion of consciousness being an activity rather than being just a simple passive reception. Yeah. Now, I think, from our point of view, I think this is the important point here, and it goes back to that comment I made right at the beginning, that our world is an interpretive world, we're world-building. Now, that couldn't happen if consciousness itself was just like some passive screen for the reception of sense impressions. It isn't. We're actively engaged in it. So when we talk about the intentionality of consciousness, we're talking about intentional acts of consciousness. You know, be they judgment or wishing or thinking or contemplating or fantasizing or just perceiving a chair. No, those are all acts in which I build up through the different mental other activities that are going on, which are also consciousness acts, as well, my world. I'm sorry, does that... that was quite a short question, but a big answer. I mean, I hope that was understandable. Is it? I mean, if people got problems, I can kind of try and simplify them.
Yeah. Yes, that never seems to really touch the sense of the intentional and volitional side of things, and particularly for those of us running groups, the fact that everybody coming along has a very clear sense of themselves, and none of this stuff is really going to touch very much of that.
Hmm.
I mean, I've been listening to this stuff for decades now.
Mm-hmm.
I still haven't got past the sense of something in me feels that it's making volitional choices, and that still feels like me.
What's the problem with that?
you seem to be saying that that's not really true, but yeah. We need to try and get past that and get to a sense of letting go completely or something.
That's not what's implied by what the Buddha is teaching. What he's not trying to do is get away, rid of our notion of a sense of self.
He's not.
No.
I know people say that.
That would be very destructive.
Other ideas. It seems to be putting a sort of... it's sort of, you know, very kind of... sometimes feels like quite an atheistic agenda with a very modernist, postmodernist, scientific, materialist view of things, which for some of us that doesn't really challenge.
Let me just try... I mean, I'll do this briefly because the sense is always within what we're talking about, but also slightly adjunct to it. What the Buddha is really trying to do is fathom out how human beings work. Yeah? Not in an abstract scientific point of view, but how they can work so that they can flourish in this world. What he sees as being a problem with the nature of the self is not the idea of having a fluid sense of self, a sense of self which is growing, a sense of ownership. Look, I'm having this experience, and it's not you having this experience. This all makes sense. You know, I'm not experiencing what you're experiencing at this moment, and you're not experiencing what I'm experiencing at this moment. Exactly, although there might be overlap in that. So there's clearly some sense of self. What he's trying to deconstruct in some ways by looking at it through experience, and let's not forget that. It's through experience, not just as an intellectual thought process. What he's trying to get us to see is that sense of self we have is a lot more malleable and flexible than the idea of the rigidity to which most of us are tied in our sense of self.
Yeah, you've asked that, yeah. Self-concept, which has ideas, which
Well, the self construct is rigid for most of us. And it's getting away from that sense of rigidity or fixation that the Buddha is really trying to see. So, for example, when we talk about these consciousness acts, for example, well, you can talk about it as this way, you know, there is an object, a sense organ, an awareness which arises, and in that there can be knowing, but in this process I can't find any fixed self, but clearly something is knowing within that, but I can't identify that as being a fixed sense of self. The idea of the lack of fixity is the important part about it, and I think this is from your point of view, what is so interesting. You wouldn't be able to affect the changes in guiding people through the, you know, the 8-week courses, for example, or the changes couldn't be affected, I should rather put it that way, unless there was that fluid sense of self, you know, where people begin to know for themselves where movement and change is possible in their lives. Now, if there was an intrinsic, fixed sense of who you are, some inherent sense of who you are, then forget it, you might as well go home. Yeah, because you're stuck with it. Yeah. Change is predicated, the kind of change is what we're looking at in MBSR and MBCT, and any, you know, just the meditation process in general, let alone these more clinical applications, is predicated on the notion that you are not fixed. Yeah. Awareness is not fixed. But these can change, these can grow, and this is an important part about it. Actually, one of the things that's spoken about in the text is also the evolving sense of these mental states as well. But then again, when I look at, you know, if I look at lobha, if I look at desire or greed, it's not fixed within me. It'll have many, many, many manifestations. Sometimes it'll be peaking, sometimes it'll be changing, sometimes it will be absent. Yeah. That's not an intrinsic, it's not, if you like, human nature. In the sense of something intrinsic. Yeah. The word that's often used in translation in these early texts is it's adventitious. Yeah. It's there because it finds a grip at that moment in time. Sorry, there's a bit of a hobby horse in mine, this one.
Yeah. I notice in a kind of sense of my own ignorance and confusion, the poison of ignorance and confusion around how to know a mind unaffected by hate as a mind unaffected by hate. Some of the things that you said afterwards were quite helpful around that, so understanding, noticing happiness is here or ease of being is here. But then a mind unaffected by hate, or beginning to notice a mind unaffected by hate, kind of brings me back into the realm of thinking rather than sensing. You know, is it? And I wondered if there's maybe a list of opposite mind states in the early sutras somewhere that can be helpful with it. So I'm not kind of looking in searching for. So what does a mind unaffected by hate look like? So hate's not here at the moment, and then as soon as I start to think that, I notice, oh, actually there is some hate here. You know, there's a proliferation of thought, if you like, in kind of looking for a mind unaffected by a particular state. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the body, again, is, I think, so helpful in taking me out of the conceptualizing of the process and just to sense, well, is there contraction or not? You know. And of course all of these are spectrums. All of these are spectrums. It's not binary. You know, it's a spectrum of the presence or absence, you know. But the body is such a powerful indicator of when we're in the grip of a mind state. And it may be even that to label it may take us too much into the concept of it. But, you know, and that's why the Buddha in some ways is so, he also really simplifies it. Is there dukkha or not? You know. And we can see that when there is craving, clinging. A bunch of other things arise. That there is contraction in the body, there is selfing going on, there is othering going on, the sense of time often becomes more contracted, and there is the flavour of dis-ease. And that also those things, just as they co-arise, they also co-dissolve. You know, so that to the degree to which there is less craving and clinging present, the body will tend to ease. The sense of self will tend to quieten or diminish or get less separate. The sense of other will get less separate. The sense of time often changes and expands a bit. And so these things co-arise and co-cease in a certain way. And we'll talk some more about that this afternoon. But that may be more helpful than trying to work from a conceptual sense of, well, what should be the opposite of hate? I mean, the Buddha says the opposite of hate is often kindness, is often metta, you know, or compassion. But there are times when those are not strongly present, but there's still not the grip of aversion. Does that make any...
It makes a lot of sense, yeah. I wonder, is there also... the Buddha's, the early texts are famous for the lists. And is there a list also that's helpful here?
Well, I mean, there, you know, at a very basic level, the Brahma Viharas, which we'll say some more about this afternoon, you know, these are also mind states. It's important to say very clearly there are many wholesome mind states that we're encouraged to cultivate, and the Brahma Viharas, these four optimal states of basic friendliness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity, you know, these are not called Brahma Viharas for nothing. So, you know, the best dwellings for the mind, the blessed states for the mind, and that in the absence of hatred, that's where, you know, metta can grow. In fact, in that verse, you know, that very famous verse, hatred, it's an important verse for our time, isn't it? Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by non-hatred alone is healed. This is an ancient and eternal law. Move to saying that. And part of that is the literal non-hatred, but in as John was saying, the phrase non-hatred also stands in Buddhist psychology for metta, you know, for goodwill. I'm conscious of that amazing story of Mahagosananda after the horrendous, you know, the awful events in Cambodia, going into one of the refugee camps after those sort of terrible things with the monks, and being there in front of all these people, and all of them had lost relatives, had people killed and imprisoned and tortured. And what do you say? What do you say? And he simply chanted that verse. You know, hatred never ceases by hatred, but by non-hatred, you know, and metta is healed. This is an ancient and eternal law. And he chanted it, the monks chanted it and chanted it, and people embraced each other and wept and grieved. As Jack Cornfield says, because what he was pointing to was a truth that was bigger than their grief. And that. I think so non-hatred is a deeply resonant term. It's you know, and it does point to the presence of the Brahma Viharas above all.
Thank you very much.
We'll have more question time afterwards, but is there somebody else who's, yeah, do you want to, just before we close?
Okay. Thank you. By not rarefying, it seems like we kind of hold a lot of these vedanas and formations more lightly. But what I find is then that I find it quite hard to express a yes or a no in situations.
Ah, the Buddhist predicament, yes.
and I can see, you know, how imperative it is actually to express preferences, or even strong preferences, you know, a very strong protective no. Sometimes, and accessing, feeling into whether something is one or the other, seems to be becoming harder.
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say about that is it doesn't have to go that way. It doesn't mean, for example, you know, simple preferences, and I'm not talking about important ones, but simple preferences about foods and stuff like that. I'm sure the Buddha had those. I'm sure there were certain things he probably didn't like. But one holds them a lot more lightly. That's the first comment I would make about it. One learns to hold your preferences a lot more lightly than perhaps we do at present. However, there are some things which, in a way, we have to say yes or no's about. For example, remember I was saying earlier on that I don't think meditation, and certainly not mindfulness as it's often taught in the secular way, is an excuse for quietism. You know, for example, often it's not mentioned, but in the text is clearly a form of awareness or mindfulness which is protective. It's clearly about what is good for me and what is not good for me. And some of that might be within my own sense of where my mind goes, but what others do to us as well. And so it's very clear that in some cases there is definitely a saying, no, I won't place my mind on that because it's just too painful, or what you're doing to me is just wrong, you know, and therefore I have to do something about this. And that's very much about protection. Becoming mindful is not becoming a doormat. Now, that's really important for everybody to hear that. It's not about not doing, it's not about not engaging in social action when things can be done. It's not about doing things and moving away from destructive situations for yourself when you can move away from those. I'm not saying they're easy, either any of these things, but one always moves into activity. And so actually this form of mindfulness itself is much, much more proactive than a simple awareness, which is saying, in a sense, yes to everything. That might be to a degree where we start off, where we have to come into a much more, a space where we're beginning to become aware of what's going on, where in a sense we're looking at and saying yes, yes, yes to all this stuff. But in the end, one has to select what is helpful for your flourishing and what is not helpful for your flourishing. And remember, your flourishing isn't disconnected from the flourishing of others as well. So I think it's important to hear that, that mindfulness isn't just about not having preferences. It's knowing what preferences are important and knowing which ones are not. You know, unless you've got a really strong allergy, sometimes a preference for food isn't that important. However, if somebody is abusive to you, that preference for not being abused is very important. Yeah. It's important for the other person as well as you, as well, I think. Chris?
Anything more?
I suppose only that as well as preferences, it's also about accessing what you want, what you actually want from life.
Yeah.
I think it's a big question. So
it's an ongoing question.
It is. I mean, I noticed that at the stage... The body, again, is tremendously helpful, because the body often knows more deeply and instinctively and presents fewer confusing messages than the mind does. And this is the value of practices like focusing, you know, which are very somatic, where one's really tuning in to the body response to situations or choices or decisions, you know. Sometimes it is a very instinctive, you know that comes through. Sometimes it's much more subtle, and the mind stories and oughts and shoulds and projections can all confuse it a lot more. And actually, I think, you know, part of the practice is learning to trust the body sense in the moment more, so that one's less acting out of habit or believing the voice of the superego, but more just sort of listening in to what's the somatic response to this situation, which may not be the same as a similar situation last week. Seems a good moment on which to pause for lunch, doesn't it? And